When the lights go out, they speak. The vanished, the cursed, the cruel. Their echoes live here. I'm Raven Vale, and you've just crossed the threshold. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Tonight's episode, The Loneliness Algorithm. How isolation is quietly engineered. There are more people alive today than at any point in human history. More of us sharing the same planet, breathing the same air, existing simultaneously in a world that has never been more populated, more documented, more mapped. And layered on top of all of that physical proximity, more connection, more communication, more infrastructure dedicated to the project of reaching one another than any civilization that came before us could have conceived. A device in your pocket that connects you, in seconds, to 8 billion other human beings. A global network that never sleeps, never goes dark, never closes for the night. The friction of distance, the thing that kept people apart for most of human history, has been almost entirely removed. And yet, people have never felt more alone. Not just alone in the quiet, ordinary way that comes from an empty evening or a long drive or a Sunday afternoon with nothing to fill it. Alone in a deeper register. Isolated, disconnected, invisible in a world that is watching everything, unheard in an environment of constant noise. The statistics on this are not subtle. Researchers who study social health have been sounding alarms for years. Rates of loneliness in developed nations have risen steadily for decades, not just among the elderly, who have always been at risk. Among young adults, among teenagers, among people who are, by every external measure, the most socially connected generation in human history. They have more followers than their parents had friends. They have more daily interactions than their grandparents had in a month. And they report feeling more alone than almost any demographic researchers have ever measured. So here is the question that most conversations about technology and society manage to avoid. How did we get here? Was this an accident? A side effect no one anticipated? An unintended consequence of tools designed with the best of intentions? Or is there something in the architecture of the systems we've built and the systems that have been built around us that doesn't just fail to address loneliness, but quietly, efficiently, and profitably produces it? I'm Raven Vale, and this is Whispers from the Dark. We were told this would bring us together. That was the promise. The internet, social media, instant communication across any distance. A world where geography no longer determined who you could know, who you could love, who you could find community with. A world where the kid in the small town who felt like the only one of their kind could reach across the silence and find the others. That promise was not entirely false. For many people, digital connection has been genuinely meaningful. Communities formed online that could not have formed any other way. People found each other across distances that would have kept them permanently apart. Real relationships were built. Real support was given and received. The technology did what it promised. For some people, in some ways, some of the time. But something else happened alongside all of that. Something that unfolded so gradually, so invisibly, that most people didn't register it until it was already well underway. The nature of connection itself began to change. Not the quantity of it, the quality. Conversations moved from face to face to screens, from depth to speed, from presence to performance, from the messy, imperfect, irreplaceable experience of being in a room with another human being to the curated, optimized, carefully managed experience of presenting a version of yourself to an audience. And slowly, without a single moment of conscious decision, we stopped being with people and started broadcasting ourselves to them. This distinction sounds subtle. It is not subtle. Being with another person requires vulnerability. It requires showing up without preparation. It requires the willingness to be seen in an unedited state, tired, uncertain, contradictory, incomplete. It requires the give and take of a conversation that neither party fully controls, that can go somewhere unexpected, that can be uncomfortable and revelatory, and genuinely connecting precisely because of what isn't managed. Broadcasting is the opposite of all of that. Broadcasting is selection. You choose what to show. You choose what to hide. You choose the angle and the light and the caption and the moment of posting. You present the version of your life that performs best with your particular audience. And your audience, because they are doing the same thing, reflects back a version of themselves that is equally curated, equally managed, equally designed to produce a specific impression. Two performances, facing each other, mistaken for a relationship. And here is what makes this especially corrosive over time. The more you practice the performance of connection, the less practiced you become at the real thing. Genuine conversation requires a set of social muscles that atrophy without regular use. The ability to sit with silence. The ability to navigate a disagreement without retreating. The ability to express something unformed, something you haven't fully figured out yet, without the safety net of being able to delete it before anyone responds. The ability to be boring, to be present without being interesting, to take up space in another person's life without producing anything. These capacities, unglamorous, unoptimizable, completely essential to deep human connection, are precisely the capacities that the digital environment doesn't exercise. It exercises the opposite. It rewards the polished, the punchy, the immediately engaging, the emotionally legible. Content that requires no patience, no context, no investment of time to understand. And a generation that has been raised primarily in that environment is encountering the demands of genuine intimacy increasingly unprepared. Not because they don't want connection. They want it desperately. But because the specific skills it requires were quietly replaced by different ones. Skills optimized for an environment that was never designed to fully satisfy the need it positioned itself to meet. The loneliness this produces is specific and hard to articulate. It is not the loneliness of isolation, of having no one around. It is the loneliness of being surrounded by people and still feeling completely unseen, of performing connection constantly and still going home empty, of accumulating interactions the way you might accumulate steps on a fitness tracker, measurable, recorded, meaningless as a measure of actual health. And this new species of loneliness is particularly insidious because it has no obvious cause. You have friends, you have followers, you have a phone full of conversations, So what is wrong with you? Why do you still feel this way? The answer, the one that the systems surrounding you have a significant financial interest in you never finding, is that the connection you've been offered as a substitute for real human contact was never designed to actually satisfy the need. It was designed to simulate the satisfaction long enough to keep you coming back for more, to give you just enough to prevent you from stepping away, not enough to fill the space that genuine human presence would fill. Just enough to keep you scrolling. Every click you make is recorded. Every pause, every scroll that slows as something catches your attention. Every post you linger on for 3 seconds longer than the one before it. Every piece of content that makes your thumb stop moving. These are not incidental data points. They are the raw material of a profile, a detailed, constantly updated map of your psychological landscape. What triggers your curiosity? What triggers your anxiety? What triggers your outrage? What triggers the particular combination of emotions that makes you forget you were planning to put the phone down 20 minutes ago? This information is not collected to understand you. Not in any sense that would benefit you. It is collected to predict you, to model the sequence of inputs most likely to produce the output the platform requires, which is your continued presence, your continued attention, your continued data generation. And what the data reveals, what years of optimization have demonstrated with mathematical precision, is that the content most effective at keeping people engaged is not the content that makes them feel connected. It is the content that makes them feel something urgent. Outrage, anxiety, insecurity. The particular electric discomfort of seeing something that confirms your worst fears about the world or your worst fears about yourself. These emotions are not pleasant, but they are compelling. They demand a response. They make it very difficult to look away. And the algorithm, which does not care about your well-being, which has no opinion about what is good for you, which is simply optimizing for the metric it was given, serves them to you in an endless, personalized, precisely calibrated stream. Because they work. Because they keep you there. Because you, in a state of low-grade anxiety and outrage and insecurity, generate more engagement than you do in a state of contentment. And engagement, as we are about to examine in much greater detail, is only the beginning of the problem. Let's talk about what the feedback loop actually looks like from the inside. Because from the inside, it doesn't feel like a system. It feels like your own mind. It feels like your own preferences, your own interests, your own natural inclination toward certain kinds of content over others. It feels like free choice. That feeling is one of the most effective features of the design. Here is what is actually happening. You engage with a piece of content, not necessarily because you endorse it or enjoy it, because it produced a response, an emotion, even a negative one. The algorithm records the engagement, interprets it as interest, serves you more content from the same emotional register. You engage again. The cycle tightens. The content becomes more specific, more extreme at the edges, more precisely calibrated to the particular frequency of your particular anxiety or outrage or fear. And the world that exists outside that frequency, the people who think differently, the perspectives that might complicate the story, the evidence that might introduce nuance begins to disappear from your feed. Not because anyone removed it. Because you never engaged with it. Because the algorithm, which optimizes for your engagement, learned that it doesn't hold your attention the way the other material does. And so it stops showing it to you. Researchers call this the filter bubble, the information environment that forms around a person based on their engagement history. A bubble that does not announce itself. That feels entirely like the natural state of the world, in which the things you believe are confirmed constantly, in which the people who share those beliefs are everywhere, in which the people who don't seem increasingly strange, increasingly wrong, increasingly difficult to understand or sympathize with, not because they changed, because you stopped seeing them clearly, because the space between you widened by degrees so small you never registered any single step. And this is where isolation enters through a door you didn't see. Because one of the things human beings require for genuine connection is the experience of navigating difference. Of sitting across from someone who sees the world differently and finding, through the effort of real conversation, the places where your humanity overlaps. That experience, uncomfortable, sometimes frustrating, often illuminating, is how relationships deepen. It is how communities develop resilience. It is how individuals develop the capacity for empathy that goes beyond the people who are already exactly like them. The filter bubble removes that experience. It replaces the friction of difference with the frictionless comfort of constant confirmation. And over time, a person living inside a filter bubble doesn't just find it harder to connect with people outside it. They find it harder to want to. Because the people outside it have become, through the gradual erosion of shared information environment, genuinely harder to recognize as part of the same world. They seem to be operating from a different reality. They seem unreachable. And so the retreat inward continues. The circle of genuine connection shrinks. And the platform, which has been the primary architect of this shrinkage, presents itself as the solution. Come back. There are people here who understand you. There are communities here built around exactly what you care about. There is connection here. And there is, in a narrow and carefully managed sense, enough to keep you from leaving. Not enough to fill the actual need. Now we have to talk about something that sits in uncomfortable territory. Because everything we've described so far could be attributed to design without intent. A system optimized for engagement that produces isolation as an unintended side effect. Engineers building for a metric without fully accounting for the human cost of optimizing for that metric. Good intentions, imperfect execution, unforeseen consequences. That is a charitable reading. It may even be partly true, but there is another layer, and it requires sitting with some documented history rather than speculation. The major social platforms have, at various points, conducted internal research into exactly these dynamics. They have studied how their platforms affect the mental health of their users, how prolonged use correlates with rates of anxiety, depression, and loneliness. How specific features, infinite scroll, variable reward notifications, social comparison metrics like follower counts and likes, affect the psychological state of the people using them. That research exists. Some of it has come to public attention through former employees, legal proceedings, and investigative reporting. And the picture it paints is not of companies that didn't know. It is of companies that knew and optimized anyway. Because the feature that produces anxiety also produces engagement. The design choice that correlates with increased loneliness also correlates with increased time on platform. The mechanism that makes people feel worse about themselves keeps them coming back more frequently to seek the validation that temporarily relieves the feeling it helped create. This is not an accident of design. It is the design, a loop so efficient it barely needs to be maintained. Users generate the loneliness. The loneliness generates the return visit. The return visit generates the data. The data refines the loop, and around it goes. Social comparison is one of the most powerful mechanisms in this loop, and it is worth examining on its own. Human beings have always compared themselves to others. This is not pathological. In the environment in which our psychology evolved, social comparison served important functions. It helped individuals calibrate their standing within a community. It motivated effort and development. It provided information about social norms. But that comparison evolved in a context of natural limits. You compared yourself to the people you actually knew, the people in your village, your community, your immediate social world. A group small enough that comparison was grounded in genuine relationship rather than abstract performance. The digital environment removed those limits entirely. Now every person with an internet connection is competing, whether they choose to or not, against a global highlight reel, against the most successful, most attractive, most accomplished, most interesting version of every person who has ever created a public profile, against influencers whose entire professional function is to produce content that makes their life look more beautiful, more exciting, and more meaningful than yours, against a curated selection of human experience that has been filtered, edited, lit, and captioned to produce maximum aspiration and minimum authenticity. And your brain, which evolved to process social comparison in a village of 150 people, is now performing that comparison against millions. Constantly, without rest, without the counterweight of knowing the full reality of the lives being displayed. The result is a persistent, low-level sense of inadequacy that has become so normal for so many people that they no longer register it as unusual. They just feel it as a vague background hum of not enough, not successful enough, not interesting enough, not beautiful enough, not living a life that looks like the lives they keep seeing. And the particularly cruel dimension of this is that the people generating the content that produces these feelings are themselves engaged in an identical comparison with someone above them on the same hierarchy. The person you envy is envying someone else. The life that looks complete from the outside is experienced as insufficient from the inside. The entire pyramid is built on a foundation of everyone feeling like they're at the wrong level. Everyone looking up, no one looking at what they actually have. And underneath all of it, running constantly like a background process that nobody quite notices. The algorithm, selecting which highlight reels to put in front of which eyes, knowing from years of behavioral data exactly which comparisons produce the most extended engagement, exactly which combination of aspiration and inadequacy keeps a particular user scrolling past the point where they intended to stop. Not maliciously, simply efficiently. That feeling, chronic, sourceless, impossible to resolve, is one of the primary textures of modern loneliness. The loneliness not of being without people, but of being with yourself, and finding that self insufficient. Loneliness, it turns out, is extraordinarily profitable. Not because anyone is selling a product called loneliness, but because loneliness produces the behavioral patterns that make people valuable to platforms. A lonely person seeks connection, and if the primary available space for connection is a digital platform, a lonely person returns to that platform repeatedly, urgently, and with a level of emotional investment that makes them highly responsive to the content and products it presents. A lonely person is more susceptible to the particular alchemy of social validation that likes and comments and follower counts provide. More responsive to the brief, bright hit of feeling seen that a notification delivers. More likely to interpret that hit as connection. More likely to return for another. More likely to spend money on products that promise to improve the life they're performing online. More likely to stay. A content person, a person with a rich inner life, deep relationships, genuine community, and a stable sense of their own worth, is a platform's worst customer. They don't need what the platform is selling. They can take it or leave it. They will put the phone down. A lonely person cannot afford to. And so the system that produces loneliness also benefits from it. And the question of whether that relationship is incidental or structural is one that the people who designed these systems have been very careful to avoid answering clearly. There is a public health dimension to this that has been building for years, and is only recently beginning to receive the level of institutional attention it deserves. Loneliness is not merely an emotional experience, it is a physiological one. Researchers studying the biology of social isolation have found that chronic loneliness activates the same stress response systems as physical danger. The body does not distinguish at the level of cortisol and inflammatory markers and cardiovascular stress between the threat of a predator and the sustained experience of social disconnection. Because for most of human evolutionary history, those two things were effectively the same threat. To be isolated from your group was to be vulnerable. To be cut off from the people who could protect you, feed you, help you survive. The body learned to treat isolation as an emergency, to flood the system with the chemical signals of danger, to heighten alertness, increase vigilance, make the world feel more threatening. Because in the environment where that response evolved, the world was more threatening when you were alone. That response has not updated for the modern context. The body experiencing chronic loneliness in a comfortable apartment in a safe city is running the same emergency protocol as a body genuinely at risk. Elevated stress hormones, disrupted sleep, compromised immune function, increased inflammation, a nervous system in a state of sustained low-level alarm. The long-term health consequences of chronic loneliness are comparable to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. That is not a metaphor. That is a finding from epidemiological research. The effects are measurable, the mechanisms are understood, and they are accumulating, quietly and invisibly, in millions of people who attribute their fatigue and their anxiety and their difficulty sleeping to almost anything other than the actual cause. Because the actual cause is not a problem that any of the systems around them have an interest in solving. Here is the shape of the trap. You feel lonely. You reach for your phone, because that is where the simulated version of connection lives. The platform detects your engagement, serves you content calibrated to your emotional state. Content that confirms your fears, amplifies your insecurities, deepens the comparison between your inner life and other people's outer performance. You feel worse. You engage more. The algorithm learns. The content intensifies. The feeling of connection that flickers briefly when someone responds to something you posted, a like, a comment, a reply, is real in the moment it occurs. It activates the same neural reward pathways as genuine social connection. But it fades faster, because it is not grounded in the full dimensionality of a real relationship. It is a signal without a body, an acknowledgement without presence, a reflection without depth. And so you return, seeking the next hit of the thing that almost satisfies but doesn't quite. The thing that takes the edge off the feeling without addressing the source. This is the structure of every affective dependency, the substance that relieves the symptom it causes. The relationship between the platform and the lonely user is not so different from the relationship between a drug and an addict in its basic mechanics. The thing that hurts you is the thing you reach for when you're hurting. And the people who profit from your reaching have every reason to ensure you keep reaching, and very little reason to help you stop. Let's talk about what has quietly disappeared from ordinary life over the same period that digital platforms have risen to dominance. Third places. The term comes from urban sociology, and it describes the spaces that are neither home nor work. The places where people gathered not for any specific purpose, but simply to be in the presence of other people. The pub, the diner, the park, the barber shop, the town square, the community center, the bowling alley, the church social. The places where you knew the people around you, not because you had curated a relationship with them, but because you kept showing up in the same physical space and proximity, did what it naturally does between human beings. It built familiarity. It built the low-stakes, ambient kind of social connection that forms the foundation of community. The kind where you know the regulars by name without necessarily knowing much else about them. Where you nod at the same faces every Tuesday morning. Where you belong to a place, not just to a person. Sociologists who study community health consistently find that the density of third places in a given area is one of the strongest predictors of social cohesion, civic participation, and reported well-being. Not the density of formal institutions, not the presence of government programs or community initiatives. The casual, unplanned, unorganized spaces where people simply end up in the same room and the ordinary magic of proximity does its work. These spaces have been in significant decline for decades. The economic forces behind that decline are complex and extend far beyond the influence of digital platforms. Changing land use patterns, the rise of car-dependent suburban development, the economic pressures that have hollowed out small businesses, the privatization of public space. These forces were in motion long before the smartphone. But the timing of the acceleration is not coincidental. As digital platforms provided an alternative channel for social experience, one that required no travel, no shared physical space, no tolerance of the minor frictions of unmanaged human presence, the case for maintaining the physical alternatives weakened. Why drive to the community center when the community is online? Why maintain a third place when the third place has been virtualized? The answer, the one that is very hard to articulate to someone who has only ever known the virtualized version, is that the physical space does something the digital one cannot. It produces the kind of connection that doesn't require you to perform, the kind where you are simply present, where your value to the community is not a function of your content output, or your engagement metrics, or the curated excellence of your personal brand, where you are just a person in a room with other people. That experience, ordinary, unglamorous, impossible to scale, is one of the primary things human beings need in order not to feel alone. And it is quietly, steadily, becoming harder to find. Now think about your own life. Not in the abstract, in the specific. When was the last time you sat with someone? Not side by side watching something, not across a table with both of you managing your phones, but genuinely present with another person in an unstructured way? When was the last time you had a conversation that went somewhere you didn't expect, that lasted longer than it needed to because neither of you wanted it to end? When was the last time you were bored in the company of another person without reaching for a screen to fill the silence? Because boredom in the presence of another person, the willingness to just be there, without stimulation, without agenda, is actually one of the conditions under which intimacy deepens. It is in those unremarkable, unproductive, unperformable moments that people tend to say the things they actually mean, that conversations slide past the surface and into something real. The elimination of boredom, which the smartphone has achieved with extraordinary efficiency, is not the uncomplicated good it was presented as. It eliminated something that was doing quiet, important work, the space in which genuine connection was allowed to develop at its own pace. None of this requires a conspiracy. None of it requires a room full of executives who looked at each other and said, "Let's make people lonely." The mechanism doesn't need intent to function. It only needs incentives. And the incentives of the attention economy are aligned with engagement at any emotional cost, with keeping you on the platform, with filling the space, with ensuring that the quiet in which you might pick up the phone and call someone, actually call, actually talk, never settles long enough to become a choice. Because the moment you step away from the platform long enough to experience the alternative, you might remember what it felt like. You might prefer it. And a user who prefers the alternative is not a valuable user. The world did not isolate you all at once. It didn't need to. It only needed to change the way connection feels, to make the simulated version familiar enough, convenient enough, available enough, that the real version started to seem like more effort than it was worth, to make the friction of genuine presence feel like a problem to be solved rather than the irreplaceable texture of actual human relationship, to make you feel in the middle of more connection than any human being in history has ever had access to. More alone than you can explain. The next time you feel that aloneness, the specific, modern, sourceless kind, ask yourself not just what you're missing. Ask yourself what you've been steered away from, and whether the system steering you has any interest at all in pointing you back. The quietest form of isolation is the one you don't even realize you're in. Because it doesn't look like isolation. It looks like being connected. It feels like being connected. It gives you just enough of the signal to prevent you from noticing the absence of the substance. And the substance, the irreplaceable, unscalable, unprofitable substance of real human presence, is waiting. Not on any platform. Not behind any screen. In the same place it has always been. In the room, in the silence. In the space you clear when you put the device down, long enough to remember what it was like before the noise. This has been Whispers from the Dark. I'm Raven Vale, and the most effective control doesn't force you apart. It convinces you. You were never really together in the first place.